Welcome to the Just Pod, a podcast by the Criminal Justice Section of the ABA, the unified voice of criminal justice. Welcome to this episode of the Just Pod. Today we are joined by Laura Chu. Laura, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Emily. I appreciate you inviting me on to speak.
Laura is a political science major at the University of Central Florida, and we're happy to have her join us. Laura has done a heavy lift for the criminal justice section this year. She was the author of a recent piece in our criminal justice magazine reviewing our first 100 years of history, and it's called 100 Years of CJS. She took the task of reviewing and compiling all of the historical documents that we had available and piecing together the first 100 years. And if you haven't had a chance to read that yet, we encourage you to. It is available to our members on our website. So if you haven't had a chance to read it, please go back and do that. I've invited Laura here today to just kind of review that a little bit, but also to kind of dig into one of the subjects touched on in the article as part of our CJS History podcast review series. So, Laura, I'm curious to know what stood out to you while you were researching our history. Were there any initiatives that you found particularly interesting or particularly valuable to the field of criminal justice?
What stood out to me while I was researching the section's history was a strong spirit of collaboration and the ability to stand up for what was right, even when it wasn't a popular stance at the time. Going back as far as the 1920s, near the beginning of the section's creation, we can see how the section worked directly alongside the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association in order to create sound recommendations for the juvenile justice system, which was being developed at that time. And a good example of the continuance of this strong spirit of collaboration would be in the section's work alongside the Center for Human Rights in the International Criminal Court Project, which I'll get to a little later. These examples serve to refute what I think is a common perception that the law is abstract or isolated, but it's absolutely not. Even from the beginning, the section has understood this and has collaborated with other groups and organizations that appear to have nothing to do with the law. And in order to come up with the most well-rounded ideas, they need a variety of thoughts and perspectives are maybe not always found in the legal field. So the other aspect of the section that stood out to me was the fact that the section has never really been afraid to take a stand for something, even if it wasn't a popular stance with some people at the time. I think the strongest example of this would be in the late 1980s and 1990s, when the section pushed for gender equality and women's rights by urging Congress to pass the Violence Against Women Act, and publicly speaking out against domestic violence, sexual harassment, and gender inequality in the legal profession. The section even addressed the bias towards the LGBTQ+ community in the legal profession as well, decreasing the stigma against members of the LGBTQ+ community. And during these times, even if people thought it was right, it wasn't always easy to stand up for these issues. So to do so, to stick out their neck like this, and perhaps risk getting backlash from the public for their stances, that demonstrates a commitment to doing what is right, even if other people say what you're doing is wrong. And I was pretty impressed by that kind of commitment being demonstrated by the section. The two initiatives that I found particularly interesting and valuable in my research were the International Criminal Court Project that I briefly mentioned before, and the Collateral Consequences of Conviction Project. The International Criminal Court Project, to provide a brief background, is a partnership between the section and the Center for Human Rights. It works to implement American Bar Association policies on international criminal justice, and their mission is to increase engagement by the United States with the International Criminal Court through education, advocacy, and practical legal assistance. I think this initiative is valuable because the International Criminal Court Project acts like a sort of liaison between the International Criminal Court and the United States, and this allows them to provide information to policymakers and members of the legal community in the U.S. so that they can make informed decisions on international criminal justice. The other initiative I mentioned before, the Collateral Consequences of Conviction Project, it serves an interesting and practical purpose. Just to provide some background, collateral consequences are restrictions that limit or prevent people convicted of a crime from accessing certain opportunities, such as housing or employment. So for a person with a criminal record, collateral consequences can affect many areas in their life, sometimes regardless of how many years since their crime was committed or the rehabilitation efforts taken by them. What's worse is that oftentimes these collateral consequences are hidden or hard to find because they're dispersed all over the place across the state and federal statutory. And because of a lack of organization, it can be difficult to find out the exact penalties or restrictions triggered by a conviction. So the Collateral Consequences of Conviction Project and the efforts of the Criminal Justice Section created the National Inventory of the Collateral Consequences of Conviction. The inventory is online. Anyone can search through it to discover all the collateral consequences in all 50 states, the federal system, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. I think that it's such a valuable resource because the inventory helped make this previously very unclear and foggy area become much easier to navigate than before. It's continued to be updated today, and I think it will remain a valuable resource well into the future and help people convicted of crimes, members of the legal community, and others.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Collateral Consequences of Conviction is one of the favorite projects of our current members. I mean, obviously don't have a lot of members from those earliest years, but I know that that's a subject that many of our members that are currently active in the section have invested in and continue to be invested in. And so thank you for highlighting that. And also, additionally, the International Criminal Court is a subject that we've talked about here on the podcast. We have a special project here at the Criminal Justice Section, like Laura said, and we had them on the podcast. We had an episode introducing the ABA International Criminal Court Project, so please go back into our inventory and take a listen to that one. So thank you again, Laura. That's fun to hear, you know, as you were preparing and looking through everything, what stood out to you. When I was reading your article, there was something that stood out to me that I wanted to dig into a little bit more for our historical review series that we're doing on this podcast. In your article, you wrote that in 1963, the president of the ABA, Sylvester C. Smith Jr., remarked on the importance of the criminal justice section, which played a role in fighting towards universal counsel to all indigents in criminal cases. Can you elaborate on this? Where did the ABA president write this? And what was the work that he was referring to when he said it?
Sure, I'd be glad to provide more insight into those remarks. They weren't exactly written by Sylvester C. Smith Jr., but rather spoken by him in his address during the 1963 annual meeting. I came across his words, which were printed in the 1971 issue of the American Criminal Law Review, in an article that I suppose was my article's predecessor. It was a really fascinating study of the criminal justice section and its history as well, but at that time, the section was celebrating its 50-year history. So going back to Sylvester C. Smith Jr.'s address, he discusses how the American Bar Association, as a whole, was urgently focused on fighting for universal counsel for all indigents in criminal cases, and that includes the section as well. Members were speaking in front of House and Senate committees in the hopes that Congress would enact a law that would provide this right. However, before I go into what the section did specifically, I wanted to provide a little background. A year before the 1963 annual meeting, chairman of the section at the time, Charles L. Decker, submitted an amended report at the 1962 mid-year meeting, which generally advocated for a greater emphasis on criminal justice in law school and the legal profession. But for the purposes of this discussion and its focus on the right to counsel, the part of the report that captured my attention was where Decker stated that the defense of a criminal case, no matter what offense or who the accused might be, is an honorable undertaking. Along those lines, during the 1962 annual meeting, the section was approved for the appointment of a special committee to study the defense of indigents accused of crime. So we kind of see here that the section clearly sees providing counsel for all indigents as a central issue, and one that they felt was important for criminal justice overall. And going back to Sylvester C. Smith Jr.'s address, he refers to the section and thanks them for their work, specifically in aiding the special committees on the defense of indigents accused of crime, which researched what was being done on this issue in all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico. And he encourages them to continue helping in this manner.
Right. Thank you so much. That's so interesting to hear about. You also noted that the historic Supreme Court case of Gideon versus Wainwright, which established right to counsel, took place the same year. So I'm curious to know, did CJS file an amicus brief in this case or engage in any advocacy related to the case?
So while the section did not file an amicus brief on the case of Gideon versus Wainwright specifically, they did engage in advocacy related to this case. The section and the American Bar Association appears to have always seen this as an issue that needed to be addressed, that all indigents accused of crime deserve to have defense counsel. Like I mentioned above, the section pushed for not only change in Congress regarding this issue, but also change in the legal community, especially among attorneys, to alter their perceptions of the criminal justice field and encourage them to defend criminal cases. However, another notable advocacy effort that I would like to focus on would be a pamphlet published by the section a few years after Gideon versus Wainwright in 1968, titled Bar Leadership and Civil Disorders. The late 1960s were when we saw a rise in social movements because of the Vietnam War and several high-profile assassinations, which contributed to high amounts of protest activity. The pamphlet addressed the right to counsel for those being arrested during these protests. The section clearly believed in the right to counsel for all who were arrested, setting aside any personal biases they may have had on the protests themselves to provide straightforward, sensible recommendations based off of their own observations that these protests led to high levels of arrests and a shortage of lawyers and an overwhelmed administration. So they recommended taking measures such as mobilizing more volunteer lawyers to help out with the massive influx of those arrested that would need defense counsel. And reading through the pamphlet, you can really feel how overwhelmed the legal community was during these difficult times. And it shows that even in a crisis, even when things aren't normal, there's still that commitment towards advocating for the right to counsel.
Laura, you and I have exchanged some emails before this conversation as you were preparing your research, and I was also looking into the history of the section as well. And in looking at that pamphlet, I noticed that it had been cited for standards for some different states. And so I hadn't had a chance to review how many states used it as a standard to help establish what their practices would be in responding to a situation like you just outlined, the riots that followed the civil rights movement. So thank you so much for highlighting it. I do think it's a really interesting piece of our history that I wasn't aware of, and I'm not sure that many of our current members are aware of it. So I really appreciate you sharing that with us for our listeners. And listeners, unfortunately, that is not available on our website, but it can be found through the Library of Congress. So if you're interested in reading the pamphlet itself, you do have to dig a little bit, but you can get it through the Library of Congress, and we encourage you to do that. So, Laura, you further noted that the work of the section towards universal counsel to all indigents in criminal cases continues today. So this seems like the best place for us to wrap up our conversation and bring it full circle. Can you elaborate on this for our listeners as well, like what you mean when you say that we continue to work toward this today?
Today, the clearest example of how the section is working towards universal counsel to all indigents in criminal cases is through the standards. In Part 2, Access to Defense Counsel, of the fourth edition of the Criminal Justice Standards for the Defense Function, which was published fairly recently in 2017, the standards explicitly express that the government is obligated to not only provide, but also fully fund the services of qualified defense counsel for indigent criminal defendants. And Standard 4-2.1, Duty to Make Qualified Criminal Defense Representation Available, calls for lawyers to volunteer as defense counsel in these cases, and more specifically, ask qualified lawyers to serve a primary role in criminal representation. And the standard also encourages unqualified lawyers to seek qualification, whether it's through assisting qualified counsel in providing indigent criminal defense in order to gain experience, or financially or politically supporting groups that provide indigent criminal defense. And the other standards in Part 2 that I want to focus on briefly, our standard 4-2.2, which states that every person who is criminally detained or confined should be able to effectively and affordably communicate with a defense lawyer throughout their criminal proceedings, and standard 4-2.4, which states that there should be a referral service for qualified criminal defense counsel, which allows those who want defense counsel the opportunity to find affordable attorneys, or even attorneys working pro bono. So for indigents, this would be a resource that would make finding affordable or even free legal services much easier. Additionally, the section has fought for the right to counsel in their policies, which recommend that all jurisdictions ensure that defendants are represented by counsel when bail is set. This recommendation was established by policy 112D during the August 1998 meeting, and also called for the modification of rules of court so that child victims of criminal conduct are able to have immediate access to legal counsel or advice. The ABA has asked for collaboration among the legal community and other organizations to develop procedures to appoint attorneys for child victims and create training for these situations for these attorneys. These recommendations were established during the mid-year meeting in 2009 by Policy 101D, Counsel for Child Victims, if anyone's interested. And I apologize in advance if I am not pronouncing the policy numbers correctly. So to conclude, long after the historic Supreme Court case of Gideon versus Wainwright, there's clearly still a lot of work to be done regarding the right to counsel for all indigents in criminal cases. I found that the section has continued to address whatever issues occur that may be blocking the effective implementation of the right to counsel through their standards, through their policies, and their call for members of the legal community to continue to uphold themselves to these standards.
That's great. Thank you, Laura. You've done a great service to our section by doing this research and piecing together these stories for us. So sometimes, as the members are deeply engaged in the work, sometimes you don't see the bigger picture of what has all come before the piece that you're working on. So I hope and believe that it'll be of great value to our listeners and to our members. So thank you again. And thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of the Just Pod.